thing.
Is that okay?
Sure. Is there anything else you want to say about Johns Hopkins?
Oh, Johns Hopkins.
Because that's you've had a successful career there in terms of tenure, but you want to do something besides being kind of like a second fiddle operator in a med school.
So I wanted to say that I was the first full professor who was female. I'm sorry, I was the first female who became full professor in preclinical science.
Okay.
The medical school had been founded by a group of wealthy Quaker women who or at least funded in large part by a group of women who required from the beginning that they admit women. So they always had women students, and that eventually evolved into some female physician, a medical faculty. The preclinical faculty, which was the research faculty, I was the first one who made full professor. That's one of the things I wanted to say. I guess that's come back to some of this later. So I'm finished.
Okay, I was just curious if you know anything about the Johns. I'm sure this is known somewhere. Johns, West Johns Hopkins. And
Johns was his mother's maiden name or something. It was a family name.
Ah, okay. So it's two family names together.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah, and he never married.
Ah.
And supposedly was a great good friend of his cousin, female cousin, but they weren't allowed to marry by the family, so he gave his money to Baltimore Charity.
Oh, there you go. Okay, and it became Johns Hopkins.
Yeah.
Oh, that's so. This intermediate step to getting here was this kind of a new school, as I really basically created in the 60s.
Yes.
And you were able to do to bring funds, research equipment, and troops there, even as a new institution. Did that represent a bit of a hindrance for people who were, was your reputation so well established by then that people says, well, you know, it doesn't matter where she is, I'll go there.
I like to think it was the latter case, and I know that at least two of my graduate students did come there to work in my lab.
Okay.
Plus, which they were getting some very good students, even through the 90s.
Mm-hmm.
All of the country started getting students, more foreign students.
Mm-hmm.
So I didn't feel bad about the student quality there.
So, this is a pretty high-tech business in a brand new shop. That's not the kind of things you would normally, I would normally expect, or that people would see as being even feasible. You know, but I mean, maybe I'm confused.
Well, I told you about the NMR entrepreneur as well, who's done very well there, and they've hired there's two NMR people there. So the place was evolving with a lot of high-powered analytical equipment, instrumentation.
So the whole idea of doing analytical chemistry was okay. It was the operation there. It wasn't.
Yeah.
Some schools don't see analytical chemistry as a proper discipline.
Well, the current chair there is an analytical chemist.
Okay.
So I guess they were. The state schools, of course, have been more interested in analytical chemistry than the private universities. And state schools figured out that analytical chemists are attractive to industry. And even start new companies, and just are generally useful to the local economy. So even this department has a reasonable number of analytical chemists.
You did mention a topic that is of interest, I think, in a broad educational sense, and that is the influx of foreign students into the educational system in this country. Do you have a sense of when you began to see more? Primarily, I assume, Japanese, Chinese.
I mentioned that Jurassic's lab it was filled with European postdocs and South American postdocs and Asian, foreign postdocs. Now, that's postdoc, not student. And while I was sheltered in the medical school, of course, I wasn't too well in touch with graduate training, but when I moved to UMBC, University of Maryland, Baltimore County, we were getting awfully good Chinese students. That would have been in 88, and they were just opening up, and they were granting visas on merit.
Okay.
Which I don't think is necessarily the case at the moment. And I, at some of the, one of the students in my lab, well, actually, postdoc in my lab, had been had placed first in a national competition to be supported by the government to study abroad, and he'd gotten his PhD at Harvard with a man named Joe Grabowski, mm-hmm. who's now at the University of Pittsburgh, and Joe had, for some reason, sent him to be the postdoc, and he was, in fact, scary bright, mm-hmm. kind of guy who forget to look at the stoplight as he walks into traffic.
Okay. Not good for his longevity. But.
Yeah. And then after he left my lab, he went to he became an employee at Abbott, mm-hmm. and tried a big Fourier transform laboratory there. And now he's working in a Chinese startup or a high-tech venture capital company.
Mm. Have you noticed that there's a continued increase in the Chinese presence, particularly in the graduate schools, or with time?
I think we've leveled off here. Mm-hmm. So I had the 10 years there, and now the 10 years here. I think we've leveled off, and we've also come to understand that the quality is as variable as our own students.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the engineering school has a tremendous number of Indians would like to come and study.
Mm-hmm.
So,
mm-hmm.
to a certain extent, it's discipline-oriented as well. We're fortunate to have good Chinese students, and engineers are fortunate to have good Indian students.
Yeah. There's that kind of dichotomy. This is when I was at the University of Missouri after all, there was a ton of Indian engineering students.
Mm-hmm.
It was primary, it used to be Missouri School of Mines.
Mm-hmm.
And there was
mm-hmm.
a ton of engineering Indian students from India, which I guess that's some kind of a traditional division. The Indians go for engineering here and the Chinese come for the sciences.
I don't understand those trends, but we also have some good Turkish students in this department. And I learned recently that we have a number of undergraduates from Japan, and that these are often children of families whose fathers were located here for 3 years or 5 years on business, and they want to come back to the United States for
school. Did you notice, as a consequence of 9/11, that there was problems with students dropped down in the number? And
well, they couldn't get into the country for the first year.
Yeah.
After that. But the university presidents made a big fuss with the government about that visa issue.
And have you noticed if there's a trend, a difference between the earlier period when the foreign students were coming to this country, as that they were staying here to work as opposed to going back to their home country?
In my experience, they're still mostly staying.
Okay.
I've had half a dozen Chinese students earn their PhD, and they're all working in this country still. And they're most of them working in companies, which is, a gift to the country.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a couple of them working, have managed to get jobs at NIH and the FDA. But one Chinese student who got a PhD from another faculty member in this department, postdoced at Hopkins and then has recently gone back,
mm-hmm.
and is an assistant professor somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
So there are some who go home.
Well, that was a point that was raised by the medal recipient last night in her speech to the reception, or mm-hmm. to the group there, that we're letting too much of that foreign talent come here for education and going back to their home countries. Rather than keeping them here, but
that may vary again by discipline. I don't think it's chemistry.
School and so on. So your sense is that the chemist discipline tends to stay here. Then, okay. Well, I think if Hopkins is wrapped up, you actually then had this very conscious decision that you wanted to move on to something more challenging. This opportunity at Maryland, was that something that you were aware of?
You mean this campus or the intermediate?
Well, your intermediate campus.
Oh, yeah, one of the faculty members there sent me a note saying they were looking for a chair.
Okay.
And
they knew that you were wanting to do something along those lines?
No, I don't think so. I'd never
and express an interest.
I never squeaked. never complained. But my children were of an age where I could take a little longer to get to school if there was a crisis.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And so it was a good time, and I jumped at the opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Did you stay, still maintain your home in Baltimore then? Or,
yeah.
And so you've really basically lived in Baltimore this whole time.
Yes.
Moving further south.
Right, I'm trying to work on the faculty of every school in the state that gives the PhD. You know, Hopkins and the two Maryland campuses, and I've also been an adjunct faculty member at the Maryland Medical School. So
oh, okay.
I've been at, you know, four of the PhD granting institutions.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting.
Without changing house.
Well. good trick. Well, it's pretty dense here, the population. Things aren't that far from one another. And, So, do you want to start a little bit on what happened when you moved from the UMBC
sure.
campus to here?
Sure, my children got into school, and I could do a longer commute, and thought that I would enjoy being in the slightly larger, a way larger campus.
Yeah.
And so...
So what, probably four or five times larger?
Well, if that one's 10,000, this one's probably 30.
Okay.
Combination undergraduate and graduate.
Yeah.
Maybe 35.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Good size.
So we made the move and reestablished. I had to leave the fourth sector, but fourth sector days were passing. And,
yeah. So basically, did you ever bring equipment with you?
HPLCs.
Okay, but not really big guns.
Not a mass spectrometer.
Yeah. Okay. But as you say, at that point, the four sectors were becoming dinosaurs, or they kind of were dinosaurs in a way.
Yeah. Now, my position was mass spec. They hired Dan Fabry, who's one of the names you want me to talk about, as a visiting assistant professor, and then as a real assistant, a tenure track assistant professor. And of course, he was able to use, he mostly used two of the four sectors.
Okay.
Because he could have good sensitivity for Fab with the two.
Okay, sure. So this was still at UMBC.
Yeah,
okay. And so he used it as a single mass spectrometer.
Yeah.
So it's always good for that.
Sure.
Then when you come here, what position did you come with as?
I was chair here for a couple of years.
So you came here as chair?
Yeah.
Okay.
And I was, and then professor also.
Now, was that I noticed that you've got chemistry, biochemistry.
Yes.
So somewhere along the way, it used to be all chemistry.
Yes, and actually the UMBC is also chemistry and biochemistry. There was some point in... maybe the early 1980s, where practically every East Coast University chemistry department added biochemistry to its name. And also in that time period, Harvard renamed its chemistry department Chemistry Applied to Biology. So, you know, it was a fashion. And I think that's the time that UCLA became chemistry and biochemistry.
did these schools have biology departments?
Yeah, but biochemistry, biology is not biochemistry.
True, but yeah. I mean, I wondered what the biology departments thought of this. Did it matter what they thought?
I don't know, and it's probable that reflected the real evolution of chemistry, that we were finding that we could address problems in biology.
From a chemical basis.
Yeah.
Which is, in the end, really, I think, a serious requirement for making serious progress in understanding what's going on. So you came here, it was already a chemistry-biochemistry operation at the time that you came here. And how do you feel about your career now? Are you more of a chemist or biochemist or a mass spectrometrist or a chair department? Or?
Well, I'm not the chair. That's a good thing. the bigger, this much larger department was... did take a lot more attention as to be chair of it. And at that point, I got very involved in the, because of 9/11 and those anthrax mailings, the so-called Amerithrax, I got involved in the Amerithrax investigation, and I had been talking to a lot of people about rapid detection of bacteria, so I just had a lot of national service at that point. So, but this is so what am I right now? I like to think I'm a biochemist. I learned a lot of proteins, a lot of protein chemistry. The biochemists may think I'm an bioanalytical chemist, mm-hmm. and the analytical chemists accept me. That was my people you were just with at the seminar. Yeah. So I certainly, but one thing I'm pretty sure I'm not is organic anymore,
uh-huh.
because those folks have a very strongly evolved culture, and their teaching is pretty uniform all over the country, and I've never taught organic at all.
Probably something that you don't regret.
That's right. It's
but that's basically your starting point.
And
the chemistry with Jurassic and these people. Well, you got the name of his book, Using the Word Organic and Synthesis and Steroid.
Right, in some order, one order or another.
Still need to find out the name of the book that won you $100. So you did actually, you came here as a chair of the chemistry, biochemistry department for starters, and this is a doubling up the size of the operation. I mean, they had about 18 people in the faculty.
And this is 45 or so.
Okay,
yeah,
so it's because, I mean, and that doubling is really more like quadrupling the amount of work. It probably goes up exponentially with size because of all the other good things that are going on.
Yeah.
So what when you got here, what was the feeling, what was the kind of the sense of the chemistry department's forte, biochemistry, did they have it?
I suppose they thought the organic chemistry was the strongest here, as it is still in many departments around the country.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And it's still very strong here, and the current chair is, I think, an organometallic person.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And so, how long was your tenure as chair here?
I did 2 years.
2 years. So that was kind of a conventional tour of duty and rotation type thing.
Mm-hmm.
Did you do anything dramatic during those 2 years? Or
I was not able to double the size of the space of the department. We did some good hiring. We hired in the biophysical chemistry area.
Okay.
And there is a pretty strong group of biophysical chemists, which includes NMR and X-ray,
mm-hmm.
that have grown up since I've been here, mm-hmm. in the time I've been here.
Was there, since you came here, some of the equipment buildings look newer than others? I assume there's been some expansion of physical plant.
Yes, that's right. This wig is built in the 70s, I think, and it's been well maintained,
mm-hmm.
but there's a new wing that's only 6 or 8 years old that has really nice, even nicer labs. But of course, the trouble with any state construction is they always use concrete blocks and don't bother about the wallboard to cover them up. But so we do still have at least one wing which does not have adequate air conditioning or adequate heating. And so it's a tough, but we always continue to work on getting that renovated, if not torn down.
Well, that's a project.
Yeah.
And so the primary, I guess the state is the big source of, the major source of funds for keeping the university essentially running the institute.
I think probably, again, most state universities have a state supported about a third of their budget. The tuition is another third. And then the overhead on external funding is the final, or donations,
mm-hmm.
which we're doing a little better on here.
But are you familiar with the tuition now? Or is
what are we here? Oh dear, no, I'm not. Yeah. I do know that the present governor has not allowed tuition to change for 3 or 4 years.
Oh, that's good. And I assume that out-of-state students are
charged a little more.
More. It's an issue, I know in Missouri now, it seems that they're wanting more support coming from the students in terms of tuition.
Mm-hmm. And fees.
And fees, right. Yeah. So that's always, it's like the taxes you pay when you rent a hotel room, you know. those extra 20%
the price is not what it's advertised. So our administration actually has figured out that science training costs more, particularly laboratory courses cost more, and they floated the idea of charging science and engineering students a higher tuition.
Mm-hmm.
And the students all objected, but I don't think that decision has been made one way or the other. But that's an interesting, just based on financial analysis,
yeah,
an interesting avenue to take.
Well, but I mean, don't they also, at least in terms of the graduate section, bring in more money in terms of students doing TA work? And I mean,
Overhead on our grants.
The grants.
We have more grants.
So it seems like there's maybe a trade-off there that's fair, and just leave it the way it is. But
which is probably what will happen. Yeah.
Well, at least that would be nice. But yeah, with I don't know, is this money crunch of the last couple of years been felt, and can you feel it here?
We had furloughs for 2 years.
Furloughs?
Uh-huh.
Well.
And this year we're not having furloughs.
So is this like giving a month away, or
yeah,
a couple of...
It actually depended on what your salary was, how many free days you worked.
free days.
How many days you worked for free.
Yeah.
And you know, because I'm not going to stay home just because they're not paying.
Sure, yeah. That's interesting, because that happened for this... My one son works for a company that used to be Motorola, and they furloughed people, I think, 1 week every quarter.
Mm-hmm.
But then under those circumstances, for the way they had it worked out, for some reason they were not allowed to work on anything when they were not.
In a company, you're probably not allowed on the grounds.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah. So you couldn't do anything, and you couldn't get paid
for not doing anything.
So.
Well, yeah. You know, if we're training graduate students, we really want to be here.
Started with graduate students at UMBC, right?
Mm-hmm.
And
I had a couple. I had three maybe at Hopkins.
Okay. And then at UMBC, mm-hmm. you were really more into the graduate student thing.
Mm-hmm.
So you were turning out, I mean, you had so many per year, or you think, I mean, that you were graduating after a while, or do you...
Honestly, I have never looked at it that way. The data's at hand, but I don't know the answer to that. And here, in the last 5 years, I've had all graduate students and no postdocs, and that's mostly...
That's interesting.
Yeah. But I've also reduced the size of my group so that we're 6, and I used to think 12 was a good number.
Mm.
But 12 is a good number only if you have a couple postdocs.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's one of the things my son at Tulane's struggling with, is what's a good number for, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just an interesting problem. You got to get it right. And
Well, I told you Jurassi had 25 to 30, and they were almost all postdocs.
Yeah, yeah. Those are, you know, self-directed to a large degree. And you said Mo and Calvin had an even bigger stable.
But he had permanent faculty members as his team leaders.
Yes, some guys can do that.
Yeah.
So when did you come here to this campus?
I came here in 98.
Okay. So...
So I've been here, you know, 14 years now.
Yeah, okay.
Almost 14 years.
Yeah. And after your two-year... I mean, were you able to actually deal with graduate students while you were chair?
Well, I had some graduate students, but that was a team with postdocs.
Okay, so you had some lieutenants, as you call them.
Yeah.
And once again, you brought nothing in the mass spec variety here, so you had to buy equipment here.
The university bought me a new mass spectrometer as a startup.
Okay, so that was nice.
And that was a QTOF, which I have... which I threw out of the lab several years ago.
Okay. So this was one of the VG?
No, it was a...
Biosystems or AB SciEx?
AB SciEx,
IB SciEx, okay.
But if you think about that, to the year 2000, right across there, automation really started leaping forward in progress, and the system I bought when I first came here was just not competitive in the... computer control, computer data acquisition, computer processing mm-hmm. of the data. So we now have this, the instrument I showed you in the proteomics facility, mm-hmm. which is, I have one, which is my student's major tool. But that kind of an instrument, it's like having a shared instrument, you know, because we use 49% of the time, and the rest of the campus uses 51% of the time. We do have a MALDI-TOF in the lab, which my students love to use because it's easy, and mm-hmm. they can sort of check their some of their samples before they go across the mm-hmm. street.
Kind of a quick check to find out if they're close before they go use the other big machine.
And we have had an ion trap with an AP MALDI source on it, but at the moment that's shut down.
Okay. So I notice, with the exception of one, most of the people that young people that I've met are young ladies.
That's right. Do you meet Joe? I have one guy right now.
Yeah.
Actually, this is the same trend at Bob's lab at Hopkins.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think that we have more and more women in science and more of the, good students. I also think that some of the men in the department probably have more men in their research group. So there's a tilt because...
So you think that it might be partially because you're a woman that, they would come and work for your...
Yeah.
Okay. Well, that's okay. Interesting. And do you get to ship many of these people to ASMS meetings?
I try to send everybody to one meeting a year. Mm-hmm. But because we're so heavily into proteomics, they don't all choose to go to ASMS. So this year I'm sending one person to ASMS, one person to US HUPO, one or two people to International HUPO, which is in Boston, so mm-hmm. it's nearby.
Yeah.
And then I'm actually going to send two people to Kyoto, to the International Mass Spectrometry Conference.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah, I think it will be. One of them is a Thai student, and we used to get, whose government is paying her supporting her to get a PhD here, so they've tested her, and she's very, very good,
mm-hmm.
and she is very good. And I thought it was a good reward to her mm-hmm. to send her to Japan. She will extend a week and go home.
Sure.
Yeah.
This is the first time that the international meeting meets away from Europe, is that correct?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that'll be an interesting
change,
evolution.
I used to call it the European mass spectrometry meeting and instead of the international,
mm-hmm.
and this reestablishes it as international.
Mm-hmm.
But the Japanese have been working on this for a long time. As part of the ASMS succession, I was the American representative to the committee that organized the international meeting in 1990-91.
Mm-hmm.
Whenever it was, I met Tal Rosa.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, the Japanese representative proposed that we should go to Japan, and a couple of us voted to support that idea, but it didn't work. I think
this would be for ASMS.
For the international. I'm talking about international meeting, which was in Amsterdam that year. The Japanese. But my point is that was 22 years ago. They were trying to get us to go.
They've been working on this.
Yeah, and I assume they've been working on it ever since.
Yeah,
So they're going to do a good job.
Yes, I'm sure they will. It's my sense that the mass spec meetings really tend to be extremely, the international conference, the Japanese, ASMS, all seem to be very rich and very strong and mm-hmm. robust, and people get a lot for their dollar
mm-hmm.
Or euro or whatever when they go to them. I don't know that any other analytical disciplines that support that many meetings, it's not like they're redundant meetings.
Yeah.
They're very...
Well, I think you do see some stuff at the fall international meeting that you've already seen. You've recently seen at the spring ASMS meeting. There's some redundancy there. This is going to be the 10th year of Koichi Tanaka winning the Nobel Prize, and I think that's part of the reason that they were able to swing the meeting there.
Yeah.
Has it been
10 years already?
Yeah, 2002.
Wow.
It will be in Kyoto, where he works, and his company is a major underwriter for the meeting.
That's Shimadzu?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I don't want to get too far into that. I do want to spend some time on your societal activities with ASMS and other organizations, but at this point I just want to maybe continue with the academic development and
sure.
what you've done here.
Well, let me tell you what I think I did here that was good, and then also we could talk about some of the students and postdocs that you had given.
Okay.
We've talked about Gerasi and Beeman a little bit, and
mm-hmm.
Burlingame and Calvin, but So if I were to break my career into phases, I'd say that at UMBC I learned to work with proteins. And when I came here, I went into proteomics. And, you know, proteomics has the aspect that you try to analyze a whole bunch of proteins at once, and you don't pay too much attention to any of them. So we introduced here the idea of using O18 to provide quantitation, comparison between two samples, one's labeled with O16, one labeled with O18, and we introduced the idea that trypsin and a couple of other, chymotrypsin, a couple of other enzymes that work by the same mechanism could be used to catalyze the introduction of the O18. So it's not a chemical introduction, but an enzyme introduction. It has a limitation that you can only look at two at a time, has compared to mixtures of proteins at a time, has the advantage that you can apply it to a clinical sample, because you collect the sample and then you do the labeling, and you can imagine that chemical reactions, of which there are some other variations, can be applied it that way. But a very popular way of labeling proteins for proteomic analysis is to grow cells or bacteria in an isotope labeled growth medium,
mm-hmm.
but you can't do that with your patients
or
even with your large animals, and so it's a method that's gotten a lot of application.
So now you're doing this for O18, for the O16, you really don't have to do anything. I mean,
right.
the
so-called light samples,
you're using oxygenated water.
97% O18 water. The isotope companies love us, and if you incubate the proteins with trypsin in heavy water, every place you break a bond, of course, you incorporate an O18. But these enzymes that recognize arginine and lysine in trypsin's case still recognize that after the protein's broken, and they'll bind the peptide a second time if it ends in arginine and lysine, and then when that's released, another O18 gets incorporated.
Mm.
So you have to incubate a little longer than you would just for cleavage. That's one of the things we've published here.
So now that you've gotten these guys labeled, what happens with them?
Well, so we have a bunch of labeled peptides from, say, the well patient, and we have a bunch of light labeled peptides from the sick patient, and then you mix those two tremendous mixtures together. Presumably there's pairs of peptides. It's the same proteins and the same peptides, only one set's labeled with O16, the other has these O18s in the ends of the peptide. So then you run through the mass spectrometer. They go through all of the workup and the chromatography together, the
mm-hmm.
pairs of peptides don't separate. O18 is not mm-hmm. separated on the HPLC column. They go into the mass spectrometer, of course, it can see both masses.
Mm-hmm.
So then you can just look at, or you can have your computer look at the relative sizes of the peaks,
mm-hmm.
of the molecular ions, say that there was twice as much of this peptide, therefore this protein, in one sample or another. So there's a lot of comparative.
So you're looking for
changes in abundance.
Differences between the well and the sick individual.
Or the young and the old. Or
to get some kind of understanding of what's going on from a biological perspective.
We were interested in changes that allow that cancer cells to become drug resistant.
Okay.
You know, most of our cancer drugs work, but after a couple months, the patient becomes resistant.
Hmm.
And so that's been a big question. The genes don't seem to change so much, but the proteins must.
Hmm.
So we've looked at, we've done that with cell culture. I haven't worked with clinical samples there. But I've been in and out of the cancer area
a lot. But you said something that's interesting, and I wanted to just ask you this very simple question. When's the last time you looked at the mass spectrum?
You know, because I'm teaching, the answer's yesterday.
Okay.
I said,
but from a research perspective.
Well, you know, we do try to do a lot of quality control as you go along. And so even if the instrumental system identifies 1,000 proteins from 2,000 peptides, we'll still look at some of them just to make sure everything's working right. And particularly if we're talking about isotope ratios, you know, where the computer has to identify pairs and quantitate the pairs. We usually do some manual checking.
Okay. So you're not willing to cede the authority to the black box.
Right. And I think most...
serious people.
We're not... in our proteomic applications have not been to look for biomarkers for diseases.
Okay.
Which, in fact, the easiest way to talk about proteomics is healthy versus sick, which would be looking for biomarkers for diseases. That's not exactly what we're doing, but it's the easiest way to talk about it.
Okay.
But also, while I've been here, though, the whole protein, the whole bacterial analysis thing has come to a head. I told you that at Hopkins we put bacteria into the 21-110, heated it and got some chemicals out, which gave really different patterns for different kinds of bacteria. My pathology collaborator got all excited there. But those were volatile metabolites. When we got Fab, we re-examined the bacteria and found that the phospholipids, which were very favored by Fab, we had different patterns for different bacteria. That was interesting too. But then when we started to work with proteins, we found that the proteins are different for different bacteria. But we were interested in knowing what the proteins were. And there are some folks who, in fact, several commercial systems right now that'll do pattern recognition or library matching without paying too much attention to what proteins give you the pattern. So we've worked out some methods to cleave the proteins, maybe with acid rather than an enzyme, and then to characterize the proteins in 5 to 10 minutes, so that this can be presumably done in the battlefield.
Oh, okay.
Our funding was mostly DOD and DARPA, and so that's been very interesting. So it's been not biochemistry of bacteria, but rapid characterization of bacteria.
There was a whole subset of work done, which it looked, I think, was based more on pyrolysis, but that multivariate analysis of the mass spectra was used to create these spaces.
Yeah, the Army fell for that.
Different things would tell you one thing or another about it.
But it's never been considered to be reliable. I mean, pyrolysis sounded good to the generals, you know? The answers were not reliable, and they did eventually give it up. The generals don't like to hear about proteomics and, you know, things, but a little more complicated to explain. But this is actually being adapted for clinical applications. I mean, the real markets.
It's in
every hospital in the country, so. The companies Shimatsu and Bruker and probably a couple more who have these library sets and matching programs and directions for have been moving their systems into hospitals, and these are often TOF instruments. And they're not approved here by the FDA, but they can be back up in the clinical chemistry lab.
Well, there's this whole subset of instrumentation that goes into looking at inborn metabolism.
Yes, that's small molecule stuff.
Yeah.
And that's, again, I don't know that that's approved by the FDA in our country. Often a lot of clinical labs do it. Certainly in Japan it's done routinely.
I think the state of Missouri does that routinely.
Okay, good for you guys.
To identify right off the bat. Mm-hmm.
The phenylketonuria.
There's like 15 or 20 different inborn errors mm-hmm. in metabolism.
Do they do it with mass spectrometry?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Well, that's that's good to know, to be reminded of. But the bacterial analysis is pretty much based on things that weigh more than 4,000, which are considered to be translated proteins,
okay.
gene-related proteins. So we take the credit for starting that in 1975. And we always said about pyrolysis that you're destroying all that information that nature put
right.
into the molecule.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'm not totally satisfied with the commercial systems right now because they do not tell you what the protein is. And they don't use proteomics. So it's so easy to get a lot more information.
Mm-hmm.
But they also, those recipes require that you culture the bacteria in a very precise way.
Yes.
And that takes, 4 hours to 24 hours.
Yeah.
So that's not suitable for the Army's needs.
No, this is, they have a very strict protocol. The companies provide everything. So basically your person
supplies.
Who does
the... profit's in the supplies.
Yeah, the person who does the
analysis.
Experiment, so to speak, analysis, is just following an extremely strict protocol with everything that's provided for them. It's nothing. Now, you've mentioned defense and DARPA, so, excuse me, you're getting money from... the defense budget?
Not right now.
Okay.
Not
but
right
I mean,
now.
You. When did you start knocking on their door?
They came in, they knocked on my door.
Okay.
So my first funding from DARPA was while I was still at Hopkins.
Okay.
And they funded me all through the time at UMBC, but if I moved here in 98 and we had 9/11 and Amerithrax problems in 2001, so then everybody got really interested in it. So by coincidence, Plum and Demeriff and I published a review in Mass Spec Reviews in 2001, and it's one of my most highly recited. But now science moves on, and we've got better ways and better bioinformatics in particular, because there's more genomes of bacteria available. So we published another review in 2008 that's also in analytical reviews, annual reviews of analytical chemistry.
Okay.
And then a recent paper that I like a lot reports a top-down identification of proteins and the identification of the proteins for bacteria that don't have sequenced genomes.
Okay. That's kind of like an unknown.
Yeah. What is
our
the bacteria?
Friend?
The question always is, what's the bacteria? But which we've tried to answer by identifying the proteins. And if the bacteria doesn't have a genome sequence, we found we can look at some of the first cousins, or mm-hmm. we can look at a broader database of bacteria sequences, gene or protein, and particularly the ribosomes are 90% homologous through the
mm-hmm.
whole families of bacteria.
Mm-hmm.
So that's been a... you've also got Nathan Edwards on the list of people to talk about. You know, that's been an approach, a bioinformatics approach that's evolved through the collaboration with Nathan Edwards.
I'm curious why... Well, you say the Army, the Defense Department came to you. What did they want you to do?
Well, they knew... They wanted me to... They knew about this 1975 paper.
Okay.
And they wanted us to, see if we could do more and do better.
So they wanted you to continue your bacterial work.
Okay. But they, in fact, I was approached by the Applied Physics Lab, Hopkins Applied Physics Lab.
Okay.
Who are much more... I never heard of DARPA as a funding source.
Sure,
But the Applied Physics Lab was always trying to get
well,
DARPA. And they also knew that we had done this early bacteria work. So I enjoy very much working with APL.
That was the connection, but were they involved in your for the Army or for...
In the first round, which was done, maybe done at UMBC, the AP Applied Physics Lab, you know, built a suitcase-sized mass spectrometer, and they tried to do bioinformatics. They didn't. Turned out they didn't do very good bioinformatics, but you know, it was before the genomes were sequenced, so I guess it was. I've also subcontracted with a local company, scientific, what is it called? SESI anyway, which also gets was funded by, in that case, DOD, and they actually fielded our proteomics approach to rapid characterization. I mean, by fielded, I mean they took it to Nevada and tested it on release.
So this is would be like in a bio war, a bio defense type of warfare type scenario that they were like trying to anticipate, and be prepared for.
Yeah, and of course, so the main source of anxiety. Good night, thanks. Main source of anxiety was anthrax. Have a good weekend. Anthrax, but then, you know, they became more sophisticated too. Well, what if it was genetically engineered? What if it was a new bacterium of some kind? And that's why we've gone into trying to identify proteins from bugs that didn't have their genome sequenced.
Do you know if anyone other mass spec operations or people in the biomass spec were being funded by DARPA or the other? I mean, were you kind of like the sole recipient of these kinds of funds?
Certainly. We have collaborated with a group in the Netherlands.
Ah, okay.
Funded by their government. And I'm sure that there were other groups. And but I will tell you, the Army, the DARPA, the defense establishment, phases up and down on technology. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so they were hot on it for a while. And right now I think they're probably not supporting much mass spectrometry for this purpose at all. And they're trying some new sensor. But they'll come back, you know, when mass spectrometry makes another advance, they'll ask us again to evaluate our capabilities.
It always keeps advancing, so.
Yeah. But they ask may not be my lab, but they're going to come back to mass spectrometry.
Sure. Yeah.
So, in that period, though, I also was asked to work with the FBI, asked by the FBI to work on the Amerithrax.
Amerithrax.
The anthrax that was mailed in envelopes to several people around the country, well, senators and newscasters. And we did work with them on that. We were able to demonstrate that the Amerithrax samples were grown in on agaros. We could tell them how they were grown on agaros. We didn't get to publish that.
Yeah, I was going to ask if that got in the literature.
But no. But what we did another project with them, for reasons I won't go into, but we did another project with them where we could demonstrate that we showed how to tell if a bacteria had been grown with a blood culture, with blood as the food.
Culture medium.
And you know, we looked for the heme. that one did get published. It's in Analytical Chemistry somewhere. 2000.
And so these people are coming to you.
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
The FBI is, of course, close at hand here.
But I mean, they can reach out to anybody.
Sure.
Well, I have an interesting question to this, and that is, would there be any value, significant value to isotopically depleted compounds in the biological sciences, say that you could get ethanol with pure carbon-12 or any other thing that you would like to have as a pure monoisotopic carbon?
I think a couple labs have thought about that, including Dick Smith at PNNL, who has such a huge team and such flexibility.
But do you see that as...
He didn't. He published the paper. Nobody's used it or followed up on it.
Well, it's hard to get the stuff.
So I don't... Well, I don't think it was ethanol, maybe.
No, but I mean, isotopically depleted.
I don't think that it's taken hold. So the there must not be compelling reasons, or somebody would, if, you know.
Okay. Well, I mean, but it's not easy to get.
Yeah.
Because we've been trying to get. My son's been trying to get isotopically pure carbon for his multi-calibrant, and it's just like if you want to get carbon dioxide, then you can't.
Maybe ethanol or methanol.
Yeah, but who wants that? You know, the chemistry to take it from where that to where he wants it is. So I was just curious if
Cambridge
people,
Isotopes would love to make it.
Yeah,
cost a bundle.
Yeah. I'm just curious if there was, if you really could get whatever you wanted that way, would it be very useful in your in a research project? I don't know.
Well, the NMR folk like. To have homogeneous
okay.
isotopes, either depleted or enriched.
Yeah, they're more into that.
Yeah.
Although I guess it'd be interesting if it could be done cheaply enough that people could take it and use it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't know. Is this a good time to take
sure.
a break?
Sure. I got through what I wanted to tell you. I wanted to tell you that we worked with the FBI and part of it.
Yeah.
So I think we're in good shape. Tomorrow, speak quickly about the rest of the list of folks you give me the opportunity to count on, and then you want to talk about larger issues like philosophy of education. And I'm going to go right now and get the book for you before you turn off your
recording
device. We'll see what the title is. This is how we got all the words in. Steroid Reactions, An Outline for Organic Chemists. Edited by Carl Gerasi.
Titled by?
Yeah. I don't think it says that in the introduction. But
cute.
Yeah. Okay.
So, you were able to get a copy of that
We had to pay for it.
Oh, you had to pay for it.
I don't know. Maybe he gave us each a copy, but...